The Goal of Philosophy 459. To Burbank, man was but a human plant, and the great horticulturist solved the philosophic problem of his life by observing the habits of the growing things in his garden. If, after the lapse of 10 pollinations, the identity of a distant progenitor was re-established, was it not reasonable to assume that men are born again to blossom forth in their descendants? Is not immortality the carrying forward of a primitive trace? And is not the urge which we feel within ourselves the voice of some ancestral impulse? For the physical thinker, to whom the invisible universe is simply a vast mechanism, and spirit an unnecessary hypothesis, there can be no immortality other than that which is carried in the seed. How small a germ man springs from, yet how much that germ contains, for in each wriggling sperm is the man with character, personality, and individuality. From so slight a beginning, what great issues come, for in the single tiny germ are contained not only the epitome of all the past, but also all the greatness that is to follow. The philosopher takes issue with the scientist not as to the accuracy of the conclusion, but rather as to the field to which the conclusion is applied. A fact is a fact, but for the clarification it may often seem half a lie. Recognizing only the physical universe, the savant limits all his premises to physical ical concerns, with the result that his discoveries are rendered of little value by false emphasis. If man were actually a body, physical immortality would be his hope, and he would indeed survive in his progeny. But since man is not a physical body, the laws controlling the body are powerless over die intangible essence which resides within its innermost parts. Indwelling spirit is not to be measured wholly by its outer form. Body has hands and feet, but spirit has no need of such appendages, except when functioning in the physical world. Body has parts and dimensions, but spirit is impartible and dimension less. Thus, while the laws of physical generation produce the actual phenomena so carefully classified by Burbank, it does not necessarily follow that spirit, which is not material, is dependent upon generation for its survival. It is obvious. 460 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. That spirit depends upon generation for its manifestation in form, but such manifestation is merely a phase in the condition of spirit. Heredity is limited to the sphere of generation, it is of the accidents and not the essence in man. While men may inherit physical tendencies, even physical attitudes, and, under some conditions, physical thoughts, this shell of personality is soulless until he animates it with his own immortal principle and gradually shapes it into an appropriate destiny. Heredity only controls such as are incapable of controlling themselves. Steeped in the vibration of its previous states, the stuff from which bodies are made comes to each incarnating soul. The life into whose vehicles it was formerly incorporated set the minute atoms whirling at a definite speed, and imprinted upon each of them its own purposes and characteristics. The child coming into the world must battle with these strange vibrations, reorganizing the substances of its body into individual vehicles, by overcoming the motion of past agencies, and revibrating the electrons according to its own needs. The plant is a victim of circumstances to a far greater extent than is man. To escape its environment, the plant must either die or trust to the unlikelihood of some gardener transplanting it to a more ideal habitat. Man, however, if his surroundings be incongenial, may move at will to an environment more propitious to his destiny. The analogy may be projected into the invisible structures of both plants and men. The evolving plant life is still work Ing through a vehicle too low in its organic quality to respond to the impulses of the inner agent. While man is empowered to resist the impulses of heredity as these incline his physical body in one direction or another, the plant must abide by the dictates of its formal part. The fallibility of the law of heredity has already been proved, and additional evidence of its inaccuracy will be accumulated as evolving man takes more of his destiny into his own hands and relies less upon the elements of chance and environment. As the stars impel yet do not compel, so man's hereditary impulses traced upon the fabric of his atomic nature urge him to follow in the old accustomed Tihi goal of philosophy 461. Way. The self, however, declares otherwise, and one by one, the impediments of heredity are overcome by the onward march of consciousness toward perfection. Whereas science fights to maintain the dignity of form and the supremacy of matter throughout the universe, philosophy would establish the excellence of life and the rulership of all creation by its rational part. If we come to worship matter and elevate the physical universe to first place among the spheres, we can never hope to establish well-being in the nature of men, or fellowship among the nations of the earth. The premise of material supremacy is wholly destructive of the moral sense and reduces ethics to a superstition and aesthetics to an artist's vagaries. All that is beautiful is thus sacrificed in the defense of a premise, and the sovereign good is martyr to a notion. More cruel than Moloch is the god of the materialist, for he would feed whole nations into the maw of greed. To remedy a condition, we must discover its cause. Man's boast of a godless age is his undoing, for he who destroys the concept of deity destroys with it the sufficiency of his own internal nature. In his pride that he is now able to govern the universe unaided, the 20th century thinker has given the divinities on high Olympus notice to gather up their belongings and depart. The gods have obliged him. Their thrones are empty, they have left for some other sphere where mortals are less vain. But man is still unhappy. His boasted knowledge has brought him doubt, doubt has brought terror, and terror has sapped away his strength. Afraid that his worst conclusions may yet be true, the materialist clings to his little ball of dirt, shuddering in anticipation of that day when he will be hurled therefrom into the abyss he himself has postulated. The heart of the thinker cannot accept the soulless universe that his mind has declared. How strange! Fickle is the mind that from pure imaginings fashions a universal order, and then dissatisfied with the fabric it has spun, convicts high heaven of man-made inconsistencies. In his New Atlantis, a work unfinished, Sir Francis Bacon recites the virtues of an ideal philosophic empire. This empire, 462 lectures on ancient philosophy, which he calls Ben Salem, the Sons of Peace, or of the latter, is ruled over by a mysterious institution designated Solomon's House. This house is an order of men united in the quest of universal realities. They are patrons of the arts and sciences, and investigators of nature's lore. The whole story is founded upon Plato's Empire of Poseidon, the Lost Atlantides, or the Isles of the Sea. One cannot read this account of the perfect state without marveling at the scope of Bacon's vision. Herein is set forth the substance of things hoped for and the prophecy of that which must inevitably come to pass in that time the gods decree to be opportune. Bacon claims America to be the lost Atlantis, adding that the Greeks were mistaken as to the sinking of the ancient continent, which was not actually submerged but rather temporarily inundated by tidal waves and freshets in the mountains. The inhabitants of the valleys were drowned, but the more savage peoples who Rome the tangled highlands escaped. In this manner culture was destroyed, and only savagery left to re-establish the orders of nations. In his Holy Guide, John Huysiden reprints the New Atlantis as an alchemical allegory, definitely connecting the book with the Rosicrucian mysteries and, through inference, with the symbols of Freemasonry. The discriminating Mason can hardly ignore the obvious fact that Solomon's house, as described by Bacon, is the temple of universal wisdom and education. Nor can he overlook the several degrees of ascent, whereby men did climb up to the same, as if it had been a seal. Acili in its philosophy the New Atlantis sets forth an ideal government of the earth. It foretells that day when in the midst of men there shall rise up a vast institution composed of the philosophic elect, an order of illumined men banded together for the purpose of investigating the laws of life and the mysteries of the universe. In this labor will be employed the ancient disciplines reconstructed and restated by Bacon in the Novum Organum. Fate decrees that empires must fall and states vanish from the earth, for, erected upon and maintained by selfishness, these shall ultimately be destroyed by the internal dissension. The goal of philosophy 463. Generated through selfishness. The age of boundaries is closing, and we are approaching a nobler era when nations shall be no more, when the lines of race and caste shall be wiped out, when the whole earth shall be under one order, one government, one administrative body. As Asgard rose amid the fertile plains of earth and as the Aesir guided the destinies of mortal creatures from their lofty thrones upon the snow-capped peaks, so upon the earth there shall arise a noble institution destined to lead humanity toward the condition of knowledge. A great city shall be established like the holy city of ancient fable, which shall be the capital of the world, the seat of all power, the hub of world administration. Here an exalted legislative body shall be convened which will mete out the justice of the wise and guide the unfoldment of the indigent many. From the seats of their authority the various heads of human undertaking will direct the destinies of all enterprise. Being in agreement with each other, these enlightened executives will move in accordance with the principles of harmony and compatibility. No longer will the various divisions of society oppress each other, for when all the parts work toward a common end, the excellence of one over another is without consequence. The time has not yet arrived when the average man is strong enough or wise enough to rule himself. Even when unfolding destiny greatly magnifies the accomplishments of the many, there will not come a day when the wisdom of the mass will be equal to the wisdom of its wisest few. As men's minds increase in capacity and establish newer and nobler codes of ethics and morals, there will still be the exceptional intellect that by divine providence excels, and by virtue of such excellence demonstrates its fitness for honor and responsibility. By an exceptional intellect we do not mean an individual who, through scheme or subterfuge, steals glory from the impotent. Such thieves of prestige have a special substratum reserved for them in the realm of retribution. We refer to those illumined philosophers and mystics who, marching ahead of the body of the race, are the only ones actually fitted to directionalize human